Blog Talk Radio.
To Paranexus Universe. Today is Thursday, July 9th, 2009. This is your host, Doug Kelly, here with Grant Rudendunst. Hey, Grant.
Hey, everybody. Happy Thursday.
Good to have everybody with us tonight. And we are welcoming back Stanton Friedman, renowned ufologist and all-around great guy. Just wait, we'll ask him. I'm sure he'll agree. And always good to have him back and talk about UFOs and ufology and all that. Now, if you'd like to call in and ask questions, we'd sure love to hear from you. The numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799. I'll put it in the chat room as well. You can also ask questions in the chat if you're listening to this live broadcast. So, without any further ado, let me give some of you know of Stanton Friedman. If you're in this field, I can't understand that, but Stanton Friedman's a nuclear physicist lecturer. He received his bachelor's and master's degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 56. He was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist by such companies as GE, GM, Westinghouse, TRW Systems, Aerojet, General Nucleonics, and McDonnell Douglas, working in such highly advanced, classified, and eventually canceled programs as nuclear aircraft, fusion rockets, and various compact nuclear power plants for space and terrestrial applications. He became interested in UFOs in 1958, and since 1967 has lectured about them at more than 600 colleges, I'm sure that's more now, and 100 professional groups, and 50 states, 9 Canadian provinces, and 16 other countries, in addition to other things. I'm sure that's an increase. Stan, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Good to have you back.
My pleasure. Always ready to talk about flying saucers.
Well, you know, and for those of you, I'm going to start the first shameless plug of your website, stantonfriedman.com, where you can see his latest books, Flying Saucers and Science. That is your latest book. You haven't come out with another one under the radar.
I'm working on another one, but it won't be out until next year.
All right. Well, Flying Saucers and Science, good book. I've read it twice. And you should go pick that one up. Also, several others that you have, you co-authored with, please forgive me, Martin.
Kathleen Martin,
yeah,
Betty Hill's niece.
Yes,
yep.
Barney and Betty Hill's story, Captured, and several others. So go check out stantonfriedman.com, and I'm sure that Stanton will also join with us in shamelessly plugging his site. So
why not?
Why not?
Absolutely.
You know, the general theme of our program tonight is, pseudoscience of anti-ufology and then the cosmic Watergate. Let's just start there, Stanton. And you've been in ufology for a long, long time.
Only 51
Roswell.
Years? Come on.
Yeah. You broke the Roswell case, obviously, yep. The MJ-12 documents and all that. But let's focus in on the pseudoscience of anti-ufology. You know, a very compelling and interesting title there. Tell us, what's that all about?
Well, I needed a title for my paper at the 40th Annual Mutual UFO Network Symposium, which is coming up August 6, 7, 8, 9 in Denver. 40 years for MUFON. And for years, I've been irked at the fact that a lot of the nasty, noisy negativists try to make it sound as if they're being scientific. Some of them are scientists by trade, my former University of Chicago classmate Carl Sagan, for example. But you start looking at what these guys say about UFOs, and it's pseudoscience. It's not science. They make claims without evidence. They make false claims, not just ones that don't make any sense. And they have confused the world because the press, unfortunately, has been listening to these guys for a time. And what I've tried to do, and I had to submit a paper to MUFON, all the papers will be available in the symposium proceedings, and I figured it was time to sort of document specific examples of foolishness, pseudoscience. And, you know, one example, and that the title of my book is Flying Saucers and Science, so this is the pseudoscience of anti-ufology. We guys who take the subject seriously and really do investigations have to show that there's no sense to the claims made by the pseudoscience types. And so there's a whole long list of them. And in my book, I have a whole chapter, for example, on evidence. And it's amazing when you look at the writings of the pseudoscientists. They never refer to the large-scale scientific studies. Now, one of the first rules of science, you can do a PhD thesis or even a master's thesis, you got to do a literature search. You got to look at what's already been done. When you look at the books from the pseudoscientific anti-ufologists, you find that they never do that. They don't reference. I start my lectures talking about five large-scale scientific studies. And those somehow never get mentioned. They will claim that there is no evidence for UFOs, and if you go by what they write and the references they give, well, of course there isn't. But when you start doing what you should do, which is to look at the evidence, do your research, do your homework, instead of being lazy and doing your research by proclamation, then you find there's an enormous amount of evidence, but you'd never know it from them. There's another aspect. Not only do they claim there's no evidence, but you have really foolish arguments. You can't get here from there. Look how far it is to Andromeda. My goodness, how much energy it would take. I don't care about Andromeda. I'm interested in Zeta Reticuli, 39 light years away. Andromeda's 2 million light years away. You know, if my wife asked me for a loaf of bread for dinner, I don't say, honey, I'll be back next week. I got to go down to that great bakery in Sydney, Australia. And she says, the supermarket's a mile and a half away. We need it for dinner. Why are you worrying about Sydney, Australia? It's the same way with the Andromeda. Who cares? I mean, our own galaxy, the Milky Way, has something like, nobody's counted them all, but roughly 200 billion stars. Some say 300 billion, some say 100. You know, what's 100 billion stars between five?
Well, you know, the thing that's really remarkable, too, is the fact that there's a lot of Earth-like stars,
sun-like stars,
within like 20 light years. There's quite a few of them.
Well, within 55 light years.
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's better.
50 of them. Mm-hmm. And the noisy negativists never talk about them. They don't give you any sense of perspective. Think of how much energy it would take. But, you know, how about doing the calculation, guys? And one of the crazy things is that there's a lot of academic scientists who think that the details don't matter. We can figure out from basic physics how much energy it takes here from any place. Matter of fact, a Canadian astronomer, Dr. Campbell, 1941, published a paper in a scientific journal in which he calculated the required initial launch weight of a rocket, just a dumb old chemical rocket, able to get a man to the moon and back. Not stars, just to the moon and back. Pages of equations. Bottom line, it would have to weigh a million tons. Now, he was only off a factor of 300 million. The Saturn V weighs 3,000 tons. Now, that means you better be careful about the assumptions you make, or you're going to look like a damn fool. yeah. which he did, of course. The academics never examine the specifics. And, you know, as an example, at 1G acceleration, how long does it get to, take to get close to the speed of light? I asked this question in seminars on campus and stuff. And I give them, it's a multiple choice question. 1,000 years? 100 years? 10 years? 1 year? And I got plenty of people saying 1,000 years. The real answer wow. is 1 year. 1 lousy year. To get close to the speed of light at 1G. Now we can stand more than 1G, but that's enough. And you get these scientists in their pseudoscientific rantings wanting to buy half an Einstein. You know, Einstein said the speed of light is a limit. Nothing can go faster than that. So you want to go 39 light years. Minimum round trip time is 39 times 2 or 78 years. Right? Wrong. Because there's another part of what Einstein said. You get close to the speed of light, time slows down for things moving that fast. How much? Then how fast you, how close you get? 99.9, 0.99, 0.99999. The big LHC, Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland there,
mm-hmm.
which ought to be starting, let's hope, sometime soon. They had a little problem with some leaks in their liquid helium facilities and stuff. Anyway, the particles in that, and they have operated the accelerating part, so we know that they can do this, 99.999999% of the speed of light. Mother Nature. We always fail to take advantage of Mother Nature when it comes to travel, except when the engineers do it, but the physicists in academia don't. We use the gravitational field of the moon. When we go to the moon, we use the Earth's rotation, so it provides some of the energy. Mother Nature, incidentally, provides particles that can go 99.99999% of the speed of light. So it's not as if this is a realm that is untouched by human thought or Mother Nature's processes. It's the real world out there. And, you know, you can easily prove if you make enough stupid assumptions, everything's impossible. You know?
Yeah, really.
You know, it. And so part of this business about pseudoscience, I mean, it sounds like you've made a calculation. You come to a conclusion anyway. You start looking carefully. There's no calculation. You made, well, this guy, Dr. Campbell, he assumed a limit of 1G acceleration. Now, we can all stand that because Mother Nature's pulling on us with that right now. However, astronauts routinely take 5, 6, or more G's. Test pilots take a lot more than that. The faster you get to orbit, the less energy it takes. But they neglect all the details, you see. So part of what I try to do is replace the mythology with facts. Another area like that, the cosmic Watergate. Now, you will hear these guys who have never worked on classified programs, you understand, with all kinds of notions that are totally wrong. For example, everything is automatically declassified after 25 years, Stan. Didn't you know that? No, I worked under security for 14 years. I've been to 20 archives. And no, I don't know that at all because it isn't true. The Eisenhower Library still has plenty of classified material, more than 200,000 pages. And he went out of office in 1961. Everything automatically declassified after X, Y, or Z years? No, it isn't. Furthermore, I get people saying, well, look, if Nixon couldn't keep the political Watergate secret, why do you think the government could keep a secret like Roswell for 60 years? It's easy. Part of it is you lie. And the two big government reports on Roswell certainly lie. My favorite lie, incidentally, it's a cutie. The second volume of the Air Force two-volume study on UFOs, on Roswell, provided the silliest explanation yet. People were talking about bodies. Well, we smart Air Force people checked, and we found that the Air Force was dropping crash test dummies. all over the place. Now, there's a couple of serious difficulties with that. First of all, none were dropped until 1953, 6 years after Roswell. So they got time travel for crash.
Oops. Oops.
Secondly, I talked to the man who had been in charge of the program. His picture's in the Air Force report. And he pointed out to me that, Stan, for these tests to be meaningful, the crash test dummies had to be the same size and weight as pilots. They were 6 feet tall, 175 pounds. Now, how do you morph that down to a 4 feet bald guy? And then time travel them, you know. Maybe it's the time travel that does it. You shrink with travel with time. I mean, you know, that typifies the Operation Mogul explanation. You know, I just read an example today where the guy says that, you know, Operation Mogul explains Roswell. And after all, it was found in the middle of June. Nobody's the wreckage, so-called wreckage. Well, that's what it said in the article July 9th, 1947. But the article on July 8th, before the rancher had been pre-programmed, said everything was found last week.
Yeah.
Now, how do you get last week for June 14th out of July 8th? Bad addition, I would say, you know, or subtraction, whatever.
So was it the previous week? Is that when do we know, or do we have a good idea of when this craft was supposedly down, when it crashed?
Well, we have a pretty good idea. We know that the rancher had gone into the little town of Corona. That's why my book is Crashed at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident, rather than Roswell crash. Because nothing happened at Roswell. It
right.
was out in the middle of nowhere, and Corona is pretty far out there. They love me in Corona. I shouldn't complain. At the 50th anniversary time, 1997, there was a sign on what used to be a movie theater there, and it says, "Forget about Roswell. It all happened here." But that's why they like my book, Crash at Corona. Anyway, we know that the rancher went into the general store in Corona on Saturday, the 5th of July, and talked about he didn't have a newspaper, he didn't have a telephone, he didn't have electricity, and it was only when he got in there that he was telling them about all this garbage that was on his place, the debris field that his sheep wouldn't cross, and you need to cross the debris field to get to the water, which is over there, you know. And he was worried about the sheep will eat anything. That's not a good idea. This metallic stuff, very lightweight foil-like material, among other things. And they told him about the flying saucer stuff, which had just started 2 weeks earlier, the Kenneth Arnold sighting on June 24th. And so we know he was in there on the 5th. They're the ones who suggested to go into Roswell because there were articles in the papers that he hadn't seen about a reward for pieces of one of these saucers, a few thousand bucks, which was a lot of money back then.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have a lot of money, I might add. He was operating the ranch. He didn't own the ranch. He was the foreman, basically. The owner lived over in Texas, you know. Anyway, so if he was in there on the 5th, it was probably the 2nd, 3rd, or 4th. And that's why all the newspapers, evening papers from Chicago West now on July 8th. I mention that because some people tell me, Stan, I looked in the New York Times, there wasn't anything there. Of course not. The press release went out too late for all the East Coast papers on the 8th. Only the evening papers from Chicago West that carried the story. We do have four time zones in the United States. The Europeans are surprised at that some of the time. You know, what do you mean time zones? Well, Europe is small, the U.S. is large, and Canada's even larger. We got extra ones. Matter of fact, if you want the oddest time zone, you go to Newfoundland. They're a half hour ahead of us, and we're in the Atlantic time zone.
Yeah, you're an hour ahead of Eastern.
Yeah, and they're a half hour ahead of us. I mean, hey, we do things our own way here in Canada.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway,
So it happened on the 5th or so, or the 4th.
Yeah, 7th, 4th, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, whatever. The thing is that the Air Force changed. They brought him in. They programmed him with a news story, and there were people who saw him in town with the military guys. Now, I should add, you have to remember that the Roswell Army Airfield, which later became Walker Air Force Base for tourists out there, they changed the names when the Air Force, when the Army Air Force was converted to the Air Force, the United States Air Force. They changed the names of an awful lot of bases. They gave them the names of war heroes, Holloman Air Force Base, for example, Kirtland, Wright and Patterson, you know, Walker, whatever. Anyway, it was the home of the most elite military group in the entire world, the 509th Composite Bomb Group. Why was it unique? They dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They dropped two more during the Operation Crossroads test in the Pacific in 1946. Nobody else could make that claim. Nobody else had exploded an atomic bomb besides them. So handpicked officers, handpicked men, high security. Now, it's amazing how those pseudoscientific anti-ufologists somehow don't bother to mention that. One of the big shots in the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, their chief scientific advisor, Dr. Joseph Nickel. His 3 degrees are in English, not French. And he worked as a magician, which is a master of deception by definition. But, you know, his scientific explanation for Roswell was an inexperienced public relations man put out an unauthorized press release. Source of information? His imagination. There's certainly no indication of that. He doesn't even know the guy's name. We were on opposite ends of a link-up during the 50th anniversary. This is back in 97. He was saying the same stupid things. I know the answer to Roswell. A press person trying to make a name for himself put out the story. Now, the notion that anybody working as the public relations officer for the 509th would even consider for 2 seconds putting out an unauthorized press release is ridiculous.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
If it had gone through a chain of command there, yeah, that never would have happened.
No, and he didn't know the guy's name. Well, Walter was not inexperienced. He flew more than 20 bombing missions over Japan. He was chosen to drop the instrument package over one of those two Operation Crossroads tests. This was an underwater and above water nuclear explosions with a lot of ships. They had a lot of them left over from the war, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
Might as well blow them up, what the heck. A lot of them are Japanese ships, of course. And you pick your best bombardier, because if you don't get the instrument package in the right place, what's the point of doing the test? Mm-hmm. You know, so this is pseudoscience. That's just one of many examples. But you get the point. Don't bother me with, there are 4 rules for debunkers. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up is one of them. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. That's another. A typical tactic is, if you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. Nobody will know the difference. And the 4th, of course, and this applies in any strange area, do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble. And nobody will know the difference anyway.
And the sad
you
part
heard
about
that before,
it,
I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the sad part about it is it almost seems to me, without sounding like a raving paranoiac, that, you know, this has been an ongoing campaign since 47, that there's been this whole movement to say, to completely confuse, confound, misdirect, and by doing so, as long as we're in a state of confusion, then nobody knows what's there at all.
Well, let me give you an example of the kind of garbage that ensues from people following these rules. In 1955, October 25th, a press release was put out by the United States Air Force. Their conclusions, because of a new study that had been done, they didn't give the title of the study. They didn't say where the work was done. I'll tell you those in a minute. And the Secretary of the Air Force was quoted, and this appeared in all the papers I've checked, not just evening papers for one day, but morning, evening, whatever. The Secretary of the Air Force, Donald Quarles, said, quote, on the basis of this report, this unnamed report, I would say, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Well, that sounds pretty telling, after all. The only trouble is it's a flat-out lie. But he wasn't the only one who expressed it. I'll tell you what the truth was in a moment. But my University of Chicago classmate, Carl Sagan, has said on more than one occasion and in a book as well that there are interesting sightings that aren't reliable. There are reliable sightings that aren't interesting. But there are no interesting and reliable sightings. More baloney. The fact of the matter is, in that study, which was Project Blue Book, Special Report Number 14, you can see why they didn't include the title in the press release. Surely some reporter would have said, hey, what do you mean report 14? What happened to 1 through 13? The answer would have to have been, oh, they're all classified. They weren't about to say that, you understand. What shows in the report is just the opposite of what Carl said. They did a quality evaluation, a reliability evaluation of 3,201 sightings. That's a pretty good size collection. And they found the higher the reliability of the sighting, the more likely to be unexplainable. Not the less likely, as Carl would have you believe. Oh, they also found that the unknowns weren't 3%, or 4, or 6, or 10, or 12, or 15. They were 21.5%.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that was a lie, wouldn't you, if you say 3 when it's 21.5?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
In addition, they had a separate category, by definition, insufficient information. If there wasn't enough data available about a sighting, despite what the Secretary of the Air Force said, it was not listed as an unknown, by definition. It was listed as insufficient information. 9.3% filled that bill. They also did something else, as you'd expect a scientist to do. They asked this question. Is there really any difference between the unknowns, they're the only ones I'm interested in, and the knowns? Maybe we just missed the boat in the screening process. They looked at 6 different observable characteristics, apparent size, color, shape, speed, etc. Do the two groups match, unknowns versus knowns, head-to-head? What they found was the probability that the unknowns were just misknowns was less than 1%. Less than 1%. And so the notion that there's no difference between the new two is more baloney. We have the Air Force as a delicatessen going here. You know, they serve baloney by the ton.
Let me just add that all of the stuff you're talking about is in your book, Flying Saucers and Science.
Yeah.
Available on your website, stantonfriedman.com, and some fascinating stuff in the book. I've read it a couple of times, and you know, there's even more. In fact, there's a couple of things I'll ask you about as we get on. But go ahead. I just wanted to mention to our listeners where they can get that.
Well,
you know, it's almost like as if they parade out anybody in a suit or in a uniform, and whatever line of baloney, or if they put a pipe in their mouth and look academic, that everything that they're saying is gospel.
Yeah, that's right, and it isn't. And you see, I don't have a PhD, so I don't need to worry about these piled higher and deeper guys.
Yes.
I can tell it like it is. And he caught it. Good. Hey, I'm a great one for giving new meaning to old symbols. One of them is SETI. You know, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I have a whole chapter in the book about the cult of SETI, and SETI really stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, S-E-T-I. And I spell out why. They have no data. They have no evidence. They ignore the data on interstellar travel. They make it sound like all we got to do is sit back and listen and listen and listen and listen. And we will eventually pick up a signal and make the greatest discovery in man's history. Somebody out there is sending a signal. There must be life out there, intelligent life. I mean,
it's so,
you know,
so contrary to reason. I agree. I just don't understand.
Yeah, we have data. Ted Phillips in Missouri has collected more than 3,900 physical trace cases from 90 countries where the saucer is seen on or near the ground and after it leaves there are physical changes. I've had lab tests done on the soil that's affected by the UFO. What does SETI have? Hope. That's all. Hope.
Well, it's almost security.
It's
almost like an exercise in futility from my perspective, from the standpoint of if there's anybody out there and they're capable of intergalactic travel, I would imagine intergalactic. Thank you. I would imagine that they have something a little bit more sophisticated to communicate with than radio waves.
Geez, considering we've had radio for a little over 100 years, and considering that Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, my favorite targets out there, only 39.3 light years away, have been around. Those two stars have been around up. Billion years more than longer than the sun, it seems to me pretty reasonable that they would have technology beyond ours. I mean, we don't use smoke signals much anymore, and I don't use my slide rule much anymore. Yeah. I had a great experience. I'm speaking at the University of Detroit in the afternoon, and I mentioned, you know, how much progress we've made in the last 50 years, and I said, you know, when I started work in industry, I was using the slide rule. And I looked around the class. Nobody batted an eye, so finally I had guts enough to say, any of you know what a slide rule is? Knew what a slide rule was.
Wasn't me.
Wasn't me.
So nobody knew what a slide rule was.
Yeah, and that was only 50 years ago. So
I remember my dad used to have one of those.
Well, sure. I mean, look, they designed the atomic bomb and the Hanford site to produce plutonium and all the rest of that with slide rules, for goodness sakes. You know, so, but what I'm saying is that that's 50 years ago. if our technology is outdated within 50 years, what if somebody has, forget the billion years, maybe they're only 1,000 years ahead of us. You think they don't know things we don't know?
Definitely.
I mean, that's absurd. What arrogance. So there are many parts to the pseudoscience of anti-ufology, but proclamations, Seth Shostak, several of the study people have said, there is no evidence for UFOs. And you look at their books. I read their books. Of course, they don't read mine. Although Seth once said on the radio, on Coast to Coast Radio, that he has a copy of my book. I sent him one with his permission on his nightstand. He didn't say he'd read it, you understand.
Right.
But
Well, let me ask you this question. What do you think, you know, what do you think these guys are up to? The Randys, the Shermers, the Nichols, the... You know, the professional debunkers, you know, what's in it for them? What's driving
fame
them?
Fame and fortune. Think about it. Mm-hmm. What qualifications did Michael Shermer have to go on Larry King? Only because he said, there's no data. I'm a noisy negativist. Have me on so I can take care of these believers, you know. And let me illustrate that. When I say that, that's not an idle comment. After we were both on the Larry King show, in 2007, his contribution was to play with little alien dolls sitting next to me. And I had a lot of people email me, Sam, I don't understand why I didn't just punch him out. I said, that's not my style. But I suggested that to George Noory, the host of Coast to Coast, and who had Michael and me on separately before, why don't you have a debate? And Michael said yes. So 2 weeks later, approximately, we had a debate on the air. And Michael started off with this statement that, look, there's nothing to flying saucers. Like with all the other strange subjects, there's a residue effect. We don't have good data, so you're always going to get 5% that can't be explained. There's nothing going on. Boy, did that give me an opening. I jumped on him immediately with saying, that isn't true. Project Blue Book Special Report 14, biggest study ever done for the Air Force, found 21.5% that couldn't be explained. The University of Colorado study found 30% of 117 cases studied in detail could not be explained. And I rattled off three more. And it was downhill from there. He didn't know a darn thing. I'd read two of his books and quoted them. When we wound up with the vote at the end of the show, 3 hours, 3 to 6 in the morning for me, which isn't fun.
Yeah, really?
Oh, my.
But I can do it in my bathroom, though. That's nice.
Yeah.
But I got 80% of the audience vote. For obvious reasons. He didn't know what he was talking about. He had done no homework. He made no effort to get knowledgeable. And that's the kind of thing that goes, that's pseudoscience. And remember, he runs an empire, the Skeptical
Inquirer
magazine.
Right?
No, that's the SICOP, or the Committee for Skeptical.
That's Joe Nickel.
Yeah. But he publishes Skeptic magazine, and they make a lot of money, I suppose. I don't know. They sell a lot of skeptical stuff, and they put on shows at one of the colleges out there, speakers and stuff, charge admission and so forth. I get a real kick out of how people tell me that you're only in it for the money, Stan. A guy calls me with that one time. I said, why do you say that? Well, I see on all these shows, History Channel and Discovery Channel and that sort of stuff. I said, well, I don't get paid for those. What do you mean you don't get paid? I said, I don't get paid for those. Well, how about Larry King? Not only doesn't he pay, but he doesn't give you money for food even. He pays a year transport and one night at a hotel, and you buy your own meals, But these guys get paid well for their lectures. Carl Sagan got a heck of a lot higher fee than I do. And he got $1 million advance for Cosmos, incidentally.
Wow.
For Contact. Contact. I get a kick out of these guys. Shermer, for example, his PhD is in the history of science. He never worked as a scientist, you understand. I spent 14 years in industry, working on canceled government-sponsored programs. And, there's another example. Wikipedia had an article about me, and one of the many wrong things they said was, well, he worked in industry on paper studies. Really? Well, when I was at General Electric, pretty much a household name, I guess you could say, Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, in 1958, we were spending $100 million that year. We employed 3,500 people full-time, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. I did experiments using millions of dollars worth of, I'll call it oddball materials, radiation shielding stuff. Lithium hydride, everybody's favorite material, and beryllium and beryllium oxide, and tungsten alloys and depleted uranium, stuff like that. It wasn't cheap. But I'm working on paper studies.
Mm.
And, that's part of the problem, is that the academic community has no idea how much is going on out there under security and at great expense. I did an interview over an hour in Roswell for the Peter Jennings mockumentary of February 24th,
I recall that.
A couple of years back. And we finished the interview. The guy asked sensible questions about Roswell primarily. We were in Roswell, after all. And they're wrapping up, and he says, Stan, don't you think that if these things were real, that half the academic scientists in the country would be working on UFO research? And I said, absolutely not. Those who can do, those who can't teach. You want a project done. You want let's say a stealth airplane. You go to Lockheed. You say, I got $10 billion to spend over the next 10 years, and they did it. the U2. They went to Lockheed, as it happens. You could go to GE, you go to Westinghouse, McDonnell Douglas, Boeing. These guys, a big research project is 3 or 4 professors and 12 grad students. That's not like 3,500 employees, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. You know, the annual budget for the 3 nuclear weapons labs together each year is more than the budget of the National Science Foundation on all its projects. There's a real world out there, and these guys don't live in it.
Yeah.
And they tell you, the SETI cultists will tell you, that there's no way you can keep something like the crash saucer secret. Look, if we get a signal from outer space, or they usually say when we get one, we will check via our protocol, and we'll make an announcement, and everybody around the world will know it, and it's the greatest discovery of all time. Now, you know, isn't it exciting? Hey, we picked up a radio signal. We think the star is about 700 light years away. Isn't that an exciting development?
Mm-hmm.
And some of them will tell you they'll help us solve all our problems. Let's see, 700 light years. Hey, guys, we got some difficulty here. Can you help us?
Yeah, really.
And, 1,400 years later, what can we do for you, folks?
On radio now.
Let's stop for just a second right here. We're about halfway through our program. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I've got a question the chat will ask and get into some of the things you wrote about flying saucers and science on evidence, which I thought was very, very interesting, and some other things. So if you have questions, you can plop them there in the chat room. If you'd like to call in, the number's there on your screen, and if you have a headset, you can use your click-to-talk button. Tonight we are going 90 minutes for this special episode with Stanton Friedman. And if you would like to learn more about Stanton, please go to his website, stantonfriedman.com. And he's got several books on there. I think you should read them all. Garrity should read them all. They're good. So having said that, hang with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
And welcome back to Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly. You're here along with Grant Rubendunst.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. We're having a fascinating conversation with Stan Freeman tonight.
Yeah, definitely. And right out of the gate here, a couple of points to keep in mind I mentioned right before the break. But visit Stanton's website at stantonfreeman.com and check out his latest book, Flying Saucers and Science. Stanton, it's good to have you on the show.
I'm delighted to be here. I love radio. I grew up with radio.
And let me ask you a question from the chat room from Sharon. Does Stanton feel that the government would still kill someone who leaks the info on Roswell? And if so, has there been anyone that is suspected of being killed?
Interesting question. I think they might take strong measures. Now, it depends what was being made available. There's a difference between people claiming, and I was just in Roswell last week for 5 days, people claiming I was there, I touched some of the material, etc., and people saying I have here a top secret eyes-only document, which if you will test the paper, you will find is from that time frame, you test the ink, et cetera, or a piece of metal, let's say, and you have it tested in a forensic lab. If they got wind of that, they'd probably do everything they could to cover it up. And so one of the things that's mentioned in the Majestic 12 documents is a contingency plan if information gets out. In other words, suppose the aliens flew around the stadium inside of the World Soccer Cup, you know, in a nice saucer and landed out in the middle of the field and so forth, the little guys got out. It'd be pretty hard to cover that up. So then we go to the contingency plan. And so it wouldn't surprise me if under very special circumstances somebody got taken out. I talked to somebody who worked at the White House back a number of years ago, and he was aware of a couple of instances of, what do they used to call it, when you get killed by your own people by mistake?
Friendly fire? Friendly fire?
Yeah, but there's another name, which is not so friendly, about getting rid of people. And he said it's been known to happen. And the government, you know...
Fratricide?
Well, it's that kind of thing. Look, in the book, Shoot Them Down by Frank Fascino, there are stories, more than 200 fatal plane crashes in the early 50s of American military interceptors. Now, what a lot of people don't know, and it's discussed in his book, and we have proof of it, the government ordered pilots to shoot down UFOs if they don't land when instructed to do so. I know, there's a lot of cartoons you can think of that go with that, but the important thing is I myself have heard seven different stories of apparently UFOs returning the favor and planes not coming back. And I get people looking at me, come on, Stan, you mean they didn't tell the families? Yeah, I mean they didn't tell the families. There's another book by William Burroughs called By Any Means Necessary, 2001. The government held a meeting that year of the survivors of military crewmen who were on reconnaissance planes that were, the expression is, tickling the radar in North Korea, China, and Russia back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, dashing in, see how fast their opponent's radar would come on, what frequency they were using, and so forth. 166 crew members died. The planes were shot down. I mean, we were violating the other guys' airspace, you know, little details like that. Mm-hmm. But the families got told absolutely nothing except the plane went down, unfortunate accident. Sorry about that, folks. Until 2001, when they called the families together and they gave them medals and told them what happened to their sons, brothers, fathers, whatever it was. So the government would lie to cover such things up.
Mm-hmm.
And that disturbed some people, but I'm sorry. Look, simple-minded, when the first atomic bomb was tested in New Mexico, July 16th, 1945, it was seen from over 100 miles away. It was kind of a big bang. And people were calling sheriff's departments. You know, visibility is very good in New Mexico. I once went in there on an airplane. The pilot apologized. It's only 100 miles today, folks. Anyway, with all these calls, they finally, after a couple of days, put out a press story. An ammunition dump had blown up, and fortunately, nobody was injured. Lying is a way of life.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can justify it, maybe, but what I'm saying is people need to be realistic about the government and what lengths they will go to cover up certain things. And fortunately, for example, when the U-2 got shot down over Russia, you know, we put out a cover story. This is in 1960, Gary Powers, famous pilot. We put out a cover story. The plane was blown off target by bad weather. Sorry about that, folks. We really didn't mean to violate your airspace. And then Khrushchev produced the pilot and the camera. Whoops. And we continued the cover story. And finally, Eisenhower stood up and said, yes, it was a spy plane. The Soviet Union is a closed society. We cannot afford to have another Pearl Harbor with a secret attack. We need to know what's going on. But what people forget is sometimes both sides lie.
Oh, yeah.
The Russians didn't tell their people about the U-2. They knew we were flying U-2s over the Soviet Union. They couldn't shoot them down at that time. And we knew we were violating international law. We kept it secret. They kept it secret. They did protest quietly, not publicly. So both sides, this isn't a conspiracy. Both sides had something to gain for, you know, keep them quiet. And this often happens. The Russians' planes got shot down by us, too, incidentally, in their reconnaissance missions. Oh, well. Goes with the ball game.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's another question from the chat room. Do you think that we are being visited by multiple alien species or only one?
Well, it depends on how you define species. You know, what's an earthling like? Well, he's got black skin. No, 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 no. He's got red skin. No, yellow? White? You know, so I don't know. In the same continent, you got tall, dark Watusi and small little pygmy guys. We don't have any reports of crosses between a tiger, you know. All earthlings can breed together, if you will. And the aliens may come from a common civilization. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there's a galactic federation out there and different guys are dropping by. I say the situation is as complicated as it was in Central America and the Caribbean after Columbus. Mm-hmm. You know, you got your French guys, you got your Spanish, you got your Portuguese, you got your English. You got guys there to steal from them, to convert them. to steal their women. Some of them got brought back, I understand. They brought back crops like tobacco and potatoes, you know. So you couldn't generalize. Their ships were different. Their languages were different. Are these guys all from the same place? Well, if it happens, they weren't. They knew each other, so to speak. They fought a few wars with each other. So I don't know. The thing is, as soon as you allow for interstellar travel, which I think is a certainty for any civilization more than a few hundred years ahead of us, then you have to allow for colonization and migration and a galactic federation. And, you know, we don't allow, the United Nations doesn't allow city join. You've got to have somebody who speaks for the planet. So we don't know what's going on out there. Maybe every library in the neighborhood lists Earth as a nice place to visit, wouldn't want to live there. And grad students from universities all over the neighborhood come here. They want to know, why is it all these people speak many different languages? They're the only planet in the neighborhood where they don't all speak the same language. Or why are these guys so good at killing? In practical terms, the Earthlings will spend $1 trillion this year on things military, and every single day, 30,000 children will die of preventable disease or starvation. There's something wrong with these guys. They're sick.
Mm-hmm. Boy, what a great Petri dish we'd make, huh?
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact. And, you know, let's be pragmatic. Way back in 1849, tens of thousands of people went to California. Go west, young men. What were they doing? They were going there for gold. And it happened again in the Klondike in 1897. And to Australia. And, you know, incidentally, some of the people who went to Australia were convicts. Maybe these guys, maybe this is the devil's island of this corner of the galaxy. They stuck all the bad boys in there. That's why we're so nasty to each other, you know. But the point I wanted to make when I mentioned the gold, gold's a heavy metal. 19 times denser than water. The Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. Cubic foot of Earth weighs more than a cubic foot of any other planet in the solar system. And you say, who cares? Well, that means there are more heavy metals. And some of your heavy metals are uranium and tungsten and gold and rhenium and platinum. And there are a few others, too. Rhenium is twice as heavy as lead, for example, and has a very high melting point and very special characteristics. So they may have been mining the goodies here, and there may be things that we don't even know are important. For example, uranium, 100 years ago, the primary use for uranium was as a yellow glaze on dinner table pottery. That's illegal now, you understand. But it does give a nice yellow color, I'm told. But and so what else is there here that we don't know is important? I'll name one, zirconium. And most people have never heard of zirconium either. But the nuclear navy is dependent on alloys of zirconium because it's got very good nuclear and corrosion-resistant properties. But the average person never sees zirconium. You know, so aliens may be stealing all kinds of goodies from here, mining the bottom of the ocean. There's millions of carats of diamonds off the coast of Africa down below. And there are many reports, over 1,000 on record, of unidentified submerging objects.
USOs?
Coming out of yes, USOs.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing that's so interesting about that is the fact that if they are that technologically evolved, it doesn't matter what we think. It doesn't matter what our government thinks. They have their own agenda. They're going to go about it regardless. If they're if like you say, Stan, they're here. They're mining mineral resources or doing anything. We don't. You know, they can do that without it even interfering. And what difference would it make? None whatsoever.
Well,
so who cares?
I don't ask the squirrels in my backyard for permission to get goodies in the backyard. The point is that we're not equals. Why don't they land on the White House lawn? Does anybody really think that President of the United States speaks for 6 billion Earthlings?
Yeah.
He has trouble speaking for 305 million Americans.
Yeah.
This is not a knock on the president, you understand, but just political reality out there.
Right.
And we're certainly not going to hold an election, even though that's the democratic way. But let's face it, India and China between them have 2.3 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
we're not going to have a one-man, one-vote election. The United States wouldn't allow that for sure. So,
or any other government.
No, you're right. Except maybe China. They'd be happy. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
We'll get everybody out to vote.
Well, here's go ahead if you got a. Then I'll ask you a follow-up question.
Okay, I'm just going to point out that this business about you can't get here from there. I love people who think we're limited to chemical rockets. Talk about pseudoscience of anti-ufology. The astronomer who's head of the Hayden Planetarium on that mockumentary that I mentioned said, look, come on, guys, what do you mean interstellar travel? Our fastest craft, the Voyager spacecraft, would take 70,000 years to get to the nearest star, and we scientists like to be around when our data comes back. He forgot to add, it doesn't have a propulsion system on it, of course. Is there a propulsion system we can conceive of? Of course. Every advanced civilization, that means more advanced than us by, 50 years maybe, will know about nuclear fusion because that's what powers the stars. We didn't figure that out until 1938. And naturally, we put it immediately to use in 1952.
To build a hydrogen bomb.
You got it right.
Yeah.
A hydrogen bomb.
What an accomplishment.
It released as much energy as exploding 10 million tons of TNT. 10 million tons. It made a fireball 3 miles wide.
Jeez.
Why would aliens think we're nice guys on this planet?
Yeah.
Would you trust an Earthling?
Maybe do you trust an Earthling?
Certainly question their sanity wanting to bring the sun to their planet's surface. For killing.
Yeah.
But I should add, I worked on fusion propulsion systems for deep space travel in the early 60s. And if you use the right stuff in the right way, unlike the Hayden Planetarium director, you can kick particles out the back end in a fusion rocket, having only 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket.
Wow.
10 million. We're not talking twice as good or 20 times or 1,000 times. 10 million times, and yet we have these ancient academics and fossilized physicists telling you there's no way to get to the stars. Take too much energy.
Why is it that we have never... I know that I remember many years ago you talking about how you worked on the NERVA. Was it the NERVA project? Why is it that nuclear propulsion as a method for space travel has never been utilized? Is it because of leadership?
It's a lack of leadership. We successfully operated several different nuclear rocket reactor propulsion systems under the NERVA program, the Phoebus program, the XE-1 program, that's Westinghouse Astronuclear, Los Alamos National Laboratory, and Aerojet General. The biggest, most powerful nuclear rocket reactor propulsion system, this is fission, not fusion, you'll understand. Mm-hmm. It's operated out at the nuclear test site, not far from Area 51, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
It had a power level of 4,400 megawatts and something 7 feet in diameter. Now, the power level of Grand Coulee Dam is 2,200 megawatts. So 7 feet in diameter. Grand Coulee is a little larger than that, you may have noticed.
Mm-hmm.
That's 2,200 Grand Coulee, and Phoebus was 4,400. The only conclusion I can reach is nobody had guts enough. They needed an Admiral Rickover, who said, "Here's the mission, guys." And there was no Admiral Rickover. GE in nuclear airplane. We operated jet engines on nuclear power. That program got canceled. We had a nuclear ramjet that operated on the ground. That program got canceled. The nuclear rockets, they were successful, but there was no mission. The worst meeting I ever attended in my life in industry was at Aerojet General. I happened to be out there representing Westinghouse, talking about radiation shielding with my counterpart out there. And he said, "Hey, you want to go to a meeting of the Space Nuclear Propulsion Office?" they were the contracting agency. Sure, I'd love to. The topic of the meeting is, what should we do with a nuclear rocket? They didn't know what they wanted to do with it. Well, we could do Earth orbit, lunar orbit. We could go to Mars. Public probably won't go for that. We could set up a colony on the moon. But, you know, how are we going to sell that? No guts! And if you don't have a leader, you don't get funded.
Yeah.
Now, Rickover was appreciated by Congress because he always played it straight with them. But there was plenty of opposition. What do you need a nuclear submarine for? Build another battleship. They can do some damage. And, of course, you know, it's kind of funny. Once we got a nuclear submarine, then somebody figured out, hey, you know what? We could put a rocket on there with a nuclear warhead, maybe several of them, and nobody ever be able to find us, so no matter who attacks us, we can attack them back. Mutually assured destruction, you know, the mad concept.
Mm-hmm.
But that was only after we had the nuclear submarine. And, you know, one aspect of that that people don't appreciate, we talk about all the psychological stuff. The Navy, the nuclear Navy, has aircraft carriers, nuclear powered, and they can operate for 18 years without refueling.
Mm-hmm.
Think of how many shiploads of diesel fuel that's.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding.
And they carry 75 little airplanes which can fly for, what, an hour or two without refueling. And I mention this only because people say, well, how could an advanced technological device from someplace else crash? Come on. Well, because it's the mothership that comes from someplace else. It's the little Earth excursion module that zips around in the atmosphere, just like the aircraft carrier is huge and is nuclear powered, and the airplanes aren't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a direct analogy here with what we do. It only makes sense.
With a fission nuclear engine, Stan,
yeah.
How fast could we realistically travel? Maybe a quarter of the speed of light?
Not with fission, but with fusion, yes. And
mm-hmm.
you use stage rockets. You know, it's like Dr. Campbell, who calculated a million tons. He assumed a single stage rocket to go
mm-hmm.
to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we don't do that, folks. It's not a good idea. He assumed a limit of 1G acceleration. Terrible idea. He assumed, and this is the thing, that the rocket had to provide all the energy. What do? We do cosmic freeloading. We fire to the east from near the equator. They put Canaveral there, not because they like Florida, but because Mother Nature helps out.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 3,000 miles an hour. There's a launch window when we go to the moon. Well, why? What difference would it make? Well, if you fire at the right time, the moon will come along at just the right time for you. Extra push it, no expense. We use the Earth's atmosphere when we come back. Poor Dr. Campbell assumed, well, you've got to use a retro rocket, of course. But of course, you've got to lift it off from the Earth, slow it down at the moon, lift it off from the moon, slow it down back here. We say, oh, thank goodness there's an atmosphere. It gives us air to breathe. And if we're smart, we can use it to slow down the rocket. You know, remember Apollo 13? You better get the angle right, guys.
Yeah. You betcha.
Well, let's go into another little bit of a slightly different topic. Two questions from the chat from the same person but related. Do you think that we are – the wrong question. Tailing on that one. Let's go to the next one. This is actually from Sharon. Do you think that there's some sort of sinister alien agenda in the works that abductions are used to their advantage?
Well, I don't know how to evaluate that. You know, I'm co-author of Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And that's really about the best documented abduction, thanks to Dr. Simon, who didn't know anything about flying saucers, but was great at uncovering what happened after, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome kind of thing. And if you look at the Hill case, and Kathleen Martin transcribed all the tapes, which wasn't the case for the first book of The Interrupted Journey, the aliens seem to be doing their thing. They pick up specimens, examine them, take hair samples, skin samples, stuff a needle in Betty's navel, and apparently extracted some fluid. We do that now with amniocentesis, but back then nobody had done that. So I don't see a sinister agenda. I think curiosity, and I've just written a paper in which I suggest that one of the things they may be doing is checking a huge sampling of DNA, because unlike our herd of prize cattle, who may all have the same father, you know, artificial, et cetera, Earthlings have an enormous variation in their DNA, and there are a lot of genetic defects. Take hemophilia. 1 in 5,000 males has it. This is an inability to clot properly. And it's a sex link, that is, the women pass it on, the men have it. And so if they pick up, you got to pick up an awful lot of specimens to find that 1 in 5,000, and there are other genetic conditions that are even rarer than that. So that may be only part of what they're doing, and maybe it's to help us, maybe it's to crossbreed a race of slaves, but the thing you have to notice is they've been around a long time. They haven't taken us over wholesale. They haven't destroyed the planet. They haven't, as far as I know, put a knife to the throats of the leaders. Every government would love to be able to do what the aliens do, that is, control your behavior from a distance without touching you. No gun to the head, you know, knife to the throat. Drop your guns now. I'd love to be able to do that. And speaking of the Hill case, it was perfectly clear when you were at the station where it happened that Barney getting off the main highway, Highway 3, onto a secondary road, onto a tertiary road, dirt road, was not done intentionally. He had to be following somebody's instructions. That led them exactly to the only place in the area where the saucer 60 to 80 feet in diameter could set down. It's heavily forested back there. So somebody was pulling the strings, so to speak.
From Interrupted Journey, he felt that he was kind of like, felt like he was almost hypnotized when he was looking through the binoculars into the craft, which is an angle I never even thought about. What you just said, Stan, about them directing them to a landing area, which is very interesting.
Yeah, no question about that. When you're there, you're stuck with that idea. And so they were doing their thing. And remember that they were kind to dumb animals. Betty had grabbed a book. They said she could hold on to it. As they're getting ready to go off the craft, the aliens took it away, and she got very upset and screamed at them. You said I could take it. That's the only way anybody will know that this really happened. And he said, you won't remember. It's better if you don't. Now, that's kind of kind and considerate, if you will. You know, thoughtful, something like that.
Well, let's explore that part of it. What do you think? Another question from the chat room. What do you think about the theory that aliens have been manipulating our genetics?
Well, could very well have been. We do experiments on animals, and I've often wondered, what do the polar bears say when they're gathered around their next meal? And I said, I won't believe what happened to me yesterday morning. These strange critters landed in a strange vehicle. I felt something on my rump. And when I woke up, I noticed that there was some device around my head, and what do you suppose they were doing? Hey, Joe, what have you been drinking lately? You know, so it's very hard to evaluate what is going on in that sense. We do things like that. We grab specimens, and we do run breeding experiments. We have colonies of monkeys and cattle, and we steal the big fish, you know. And
yeah, but the big difference is, you know, we're talking about sentient versus non-sentient.
Yeah, but as I said, they're kind to dumb animals.
Yeah.
I mean,
speak for yourself there.
Well, I'm not saying I would like, I mean, the thing that abductees, that seems to bother abductees, is nobody asks for permission.
Yeah.
Okay, but I don't ask for permission of the squirrels in my backyard, you know.
But again, they're not sentient, you know.
Well, they feel stuff, too. How do you know what a squirrel is thinking? Yeah. He can't read, maybe, but...
Yesterday, when I was talking to the squirrel out in my backyard, he didn't talk back, so I don't think he's sentient. Sound good?
Well, he probably thought this idiot thinks that I can talk to him.
And yeah, that big thing's going to eat me.
Yeah, really. All right. So here's another question in the chat room. We've got less than 14 minutes to go, so I want to get some of these questions up. Do you subscribe to the holographic universe philosophy?
No. I'm not sure I know what that means, but no.
I
don't know how to deal with fourth-dimensional space-time warping, and I also don't know how to deal with 11-dimensional string theory. Of course, they provide no evidence that that is other than a beautiful theory. No experimental evidence to verify any of it. But what's wrong with the world in which we live with a little advancement hither, thither, and yon?
Yeah.
I mean, look at the microcircuits of today. And look at the computers when I started work 50 years ago. Besides slide rules, we took up a building up the road, loads of air conditioning equipment, input data was put in by key punching, a bunch of cards, and this 64K computer, you know. And we paid $500 an hour for the privilege of using it. Look where we are now. You can buy a little device that you can put under the skin that sends out a signal that you can wave a wand at and find out the name, the number, the identification of the critter that has the device under his skin.
Yeah.
If I'd said that 50 years ago, you'd have said, you're crazy, man.
Well, okay, so let's segue now into a couple of areas that I really wanted to address with you.
Okay.
Get your feedback on them. In terms of progress over the last, I mean, we've made progress, obviously, over the last 50 years, a lot of it. But, you know, over the last 10, 20 years, what kind of progress have we made in the field of ufology?
Well, we've got a lot of documents. We've shown a lot of documents for fraudulent. I believe I've shown in Secret Magic, my book about the Majestic 12 documents, the second edition, 2005, that some of them are genuine. We've shown that a lot of them are fraudulent, and you expect the market to be flooded by garbage when good stuff gets out. We've come to a greater understanding of governments lying. Remember all those weapons of mass destruction that, gee whiz, didn't seem to be there, you know. Isn't that amazing? We've made a lot of people, the polls, the opinion polls, and there's a whole chapter in the book, there are more believers than non-believers. And the greater the education, the more likely to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So we've made progress in terms of the public. You know, when I was a kid, if you talked about space travel, they'd say, oh, he's a smart kid, but something wrong with him. He's talking about going to the moon and stuff. Everybody, there's a whole two generations that were never alive and there wasn't a space program. So attitudes have changed. Have we gone far enough? Of course not.
Where would you, what do you see? What do we do now? I mean, we've collected tons of cases, lots of trace evidence, you know, sightings out the yin-yang. You know, for the researcher today, for the next generation researcher, what should we be looking at? What direction should we be going?
Well, there's a very exciting development. Robert Bigelow of Las Vegas, a billionaire guy who got his own space program, Bigelow Aerospace, got stuff up there now.
Inflatable spacecraft.
Yeah. He's funding a number of investigations by MUFON this year. And funding has been a real sore spot. You know, it costs money to send people to run tests, to do all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, certain cases have already been funded. So that's a good thing. Another good thing is that MUFON got access to the FAA radar tapes in the Stephenville case, you know?
Oh, really?
And had a guy who was very knowledgeable about analyzing radar tapes, was able to show that, gee, there was a large thing there that stopped. And there were these other things that were going very fast. Remember the Air Force tried to say, no, we didn't have any F-16s up, and 10 days later, oh, you know, we had 10 of them up. So that's a nice kind of data, electromagnetic data like that radar stuff. So I think also we'll be making more effort to solicit former military guys for what I would call deathbed confessions, maybe a piece of material that's been sitting in the bureau drawer for 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think there have been many more crashes than we know about. Remember what General Bolander said. Reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with JNAP 146, Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. That's an incredible statement. That was 1969. Because of his memo, Blue Book was canceled. So there should be lots of people out there familiar with the cases that could affect national security. It's also flying down the runway at a SAC base where nuclear weapons are stored, for example. And with the current attitude toward government and lies, it may be we can get some of these people to talk. If they go to my website, they find out how to call me, email me. I don't use witness names without permission. This is not an act of solicitation for an act of treason. I would like to hear from anybody who has information to pass on.
And your website is?
www.stantonfriedman.com.
Cool. Now, so here's my thought. You know, we've collected all this evidence, and yes, you know, if we could get some thing around or some concrete document, or, you know, somebody, you know, from Roswell tucked away a piece of the craft or something sitting in a drawer, like you said, something like that, you know, that would be great. But in absence of that, you know, I mean, you can only document so many sightings, so many trace evidence cases, and, you know, we're still kind of at the same point. We don't, where do we
well,
go from here?
True, but a multiple witness radar visual case where somebody has the tapes would be very useful.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, if you get enough public distress with the cover-up,
mm-hmm.
Once one guy comes forward and another guy comes forward, and then pretty soon, what are you going to do, shoot them all?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you would in some other countries. It's pretty mm-hmm. hard to do in the United States.
So here's a question from the chat.
Let's be an optimist.
Go ahead if you want to finish. We've got 7 minutes
left.
Here's a question. So if someone sees a crashed craft, who could they call rather than the government? Who could get a look at it before the government?
Mutual UFO Network. Call me. I'll find somebody near them, get a little piece, take some pictures. Don't blab about it to the local newspaper until, you know, you got things in better hand than that.
Mm-hmm.
Get some professional people to stand up, talk to Bob's people, talk to MUFON.
Okay.
And let's do it right, in other words.
Right.
Let's not just talk. Let's protect it. Put a perimeter on it. The kicker here, incidentally, is the government's got the best means for detection. All the radar systems, the spy satellites, all that sort of thing. That data is all Bourne classified, so they can tell when something's come down. They can zero in from some of the spy satellites. You know, you can read the license plate in the Kremlin parking lot, you know. So they can subject and get troops out there pretty quick. There are recovery teams. When the Cosmos 954, nuclear-powered Soviet satellite, came down 3 decades ago in the northern Canada, anyway. Everybody's worrying about that area. It's Great Slave Lake. There ain't nobody there. There's a bunch of caribou. That's about it. When that came down, there were recovery teams that went there from Los Alamos, as a matter of fact.
Of course, they knew it was
coming.
They knew it was coming.
They knew where. They knew where it had come down. Our techniques weren't as good back then, but we were following it, paying careful attention. And why did we go after it? Because we wanted to know what their technology was, because that was the 13th Russian one, and we only put up one, and it was lousy. And, you know, it's interesting. None of the press coverage pointed out what was really important was not the radiation to the caribou, but the fact that the Soviets had more electrical energy available in their satellites than we did, which meant laser weapons, which meant sideband radar, particle beams, all this sort of stuff. None of the press coverage mentioned that. Isn't that amazing?
Always. So one other thing that I'd like to just comment on and get you to relate it a little bit in our 4 minutes remaining or less. In your book, Flying Saucers and Science, you talk about evidence. And, you know, the thing about the mainstream scientific community is, you know, we need evidence. You know, witnesses is just not good enough. We need some kind of substantial evidence. In your book, I love what you do. You talk about four types of evidence, the scientific method. You know, for example, a car crash scene. You know, you can't go reproduce it. So you have to come to a conclusion based on the forensic evidence. And
you measure the skid marks, the brake linings, the alcohol level in the driver, all kinds of things. Reproducibility is not the only test for science.
Good.
You got to be ready. Earthquakes, I can't predict them. I know they're going to happen. But you can have instruments set up to monitor them. And we do have instruments to monitor the sky, but you and I don't get access to that data.
Yeah. See, and that was, to me, you know, that was a great point, you know, and that's something to keep in mind as we still continue to try to remain objective in our, but still there are the types of proving things scientifically rather than just having a body or a craft or something like that. So that's good
stuff. Yeah, and especially if the people who have those things aren't going to put them on public display. They have the detection systems, and they have the monitoring systems and the protection systems, and we don't.
Great. Any last questions, Grant?
None that I can think of. It's been great having you with us tonight, Stan, and as always, it's fascinating stuff, and, you know, you made an incredible contribution to the field with all of your works and publications.
Yes.
And keep cranking them out because we love it. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
I'm the Grandma Moses of the UFO book.
Yeah, but some great stuff, you know. And
absolutely.
And I'll tell you, you know, even before we had you, you know, I talked to you on Captain Jack's program here a couple, 3 years ago or whatever. And, you know, in the years prior to that, I've seen you on documentaries. I always respected what you said. Because it was objective, it was logical, and you had your facts. And I just wanted to tell you, you know, that's what I appreciate, and I thank you for it.
Well, thank you very much. That's what I'm striving for, to let people know there is a sensible way to approach the problem. You don't need to buy into the nonsense from the nasty, noisy negativists or the ancient academics or fossilized physicists.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the facts and the data. It's there.
Yep.
They are.
So to our listeners, go visit stantonfriedman.com. Flying to the Science is his latest book, but he's got several, and they're all good. So, Stanton, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate your time. And to our listeners, thank you, Stan. You have a good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And to our listeners, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We appreciate your questions. Hopefully it was of value to you as well. Next week, our own Mike Jones is going to co-hosting the show. He's going to be talking about the alien abduction phenomena and what people can do so that they are alien abductees. So you want to check out that program. Of course, Mike is, and he's going to share what's worked for him. So be sure and tune in on that one. Week after, we're going to be having a panel discussion on the future of the paranormal field, reinventing the field, and talking about what we can do as investigators and researchers from here on out, because it's time to change things up a little bit. If you're not a Paranexus member, we'd love to have you as a member. Visit paranexus.org. It's an association of researchers. We really try to remain objective and professional. And so if that's your forte, we would love to have you come pay a visit. Grant, another good week.
Yeah. Interesting show. It's always a pleasure to have Stanton with us, and I want to wish everybody out there and our listening audience a great weekend ahead, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week.
All right, everyone, take care. Have a great week. Good night.
Good night.
It's Paranexus Universe.